Hello and welcome to Pod Academy. This week there's been widespread concern over the use of online data by security services in the UK and America. So how free are we on the web? That was the question posed in a discussion organised by Index on Censorship. They brought together science fiction author Cory Doctorow, investigative journalist Heather Brooke, lawyer Paul Tweed and Kirsty Hughes, the chief executive of Index. The discussion was chaired by David Aronovich. First up was Cory Doctorow.
I always say that I'm both a pessimist because I have seen firsthand and believe that technology can compromise our liberties in ways that make Orwell look like a hunter. And we're starting to see that now, that the degree to which surveillance and censorship and arbitrary control can be embodied in our computers, and our computers are really everywhere. They're inside our bodies, we are inside of them. This building, take the computers out of it, it ceases to be habitable pretty quickly. So this building is just a computer that our bodies happen to be in. That those powers are being extended and have the potential to control us in ways that are really quite nightmarish. But at the same time, computers enable us to cooperate and collaborate in ways that really beggar the imaginations of people who've tried to get their friends and families together to do something since the first primates became social and said, you know, you look out for the kids and I'll look out for tigers and that one will go and find the bananas, and had to coordinate their effort to kind of get along. So when I was an activist in the 1980s in Canada, 98% of my job was stuffing envelopes and writing addresses on them, and 2% was figuring out what to put in the envelopes. And we got the envelopes for free now, thanks to the internet. And so what this has meant is that there are many different ways of engaging with activist causes, whatever your activist cause may be, than were ever available to us in earlier activist circles. And I think that this is an unalloyed good, but ironically, it's been the source of an enormous amount of criticism lately from people who say that it enables something they sneeringly call clicktivism, a kind of activism light in which people who care about a cause have their activist energy diffused by merely going and ticking a box on 38 degrees that says, no, I'm quite for that, I'm quite against that. And then they toddle off having used up all their activist energy. And what I think is that, as every retailer and every preacher has known, that the secret is to get people in the door. You have to get people involved to get them more involved. And when the first step to take in an activist cause was to literally put your body in potential harm's way and join a demonstration or a sit-in or something, the number of people who were able to engage was necessarily smaller. It was a very big first step to take. And more importantly, the number of people who could stay engaged was also smaller. Because in order to do that on a regular basis, you either have to have the privilege of being able to afford to lose something or nothing to lose at all. And that's why activist groups tend to be pretty homogenous and they tend to be pretty blokey. You don't see a lot of mums in on the street in activist causes, not because mums don't care about activist causes, but because when you have a kid that you're taking care of, sometimes it's very hard to say, well, I'm going to risk a night in the cells. And so I'm very glad to see that we have enabled a smooth curve of engagement on all these ways to engage using the internet, and it makes me optimistic. And it makes me feel like the people who sneer at it are coming from a very privileged and unempathic place, a place that says that, you know, that they believe that they have a theory of change, that the world can be moved by only people who have nothing to lose and only people who can afford to lose something and no one in between. And so I'd like to put my flag now at the end of my intervention as a kind of flag for clicktivism, in support of clicktivism. Thank you.
Journalist Heather Brooke had been investigating MPs' expenses for 5 years before The Telegraph broke the story.
I came out because I was doing this case trying to get MPs' expenses, and originally I was after the paper records because that's how they were all kept. And when I finally won this 5-year legal battle to get them released, the way they were eventually going to be released was that they were all being scanned into a digital database. Well, Parliament didn't, they were meant to make that public, they refused, they kept delaying it, saying it would be dangerous in different ways, it was costing too much money. Eventually, as you all will know, that somebody inside the actual redaction room made this digital copy, just an entire copy of that database, and then hopped it around to different newspapers, and the Telegraph bought it, and it all came out. So I saw this amazing, that's where I really saw the revolutionary aspect of what digitization would do. But then on the other hand, as I started to meet and talk to all of these hacktivists, I also saw the underside of this digital revolution, which was that as we move all of our lives online, we create a really handy one-stop shop for the nosy official. And our laws are definitely not keeping pace with how our lives are now online. So I look through the laws of America because actually America has the most codified protections for against unwarranted search and seizure. And yet we can see now very clearly how even in the country that has the most protections, the kind of abuses that have been happening. We spend a lot of time, particularly in Britain, about how dangerous free speech is, getting all worked up about tweets and offensive speech and isn't it all dangerous. Well, actually, throughout history, free speech has never been the danger to humanity. It's the concentration of power. And what's even more dangerous is the concentration of power in the secretive arms of the state. And there I'm talking about the intelligence agencies. And that's exactly what we're in now. We're in this security state where we have a huge portion of the state now secret, interpreting laws that, and we don't know, none of this is being put up for public debate. Apparently there's oversight, but even the oversight is quite secretive. And even the way they try and, even the way the whole system operates is incredibly opaque. And you just can't get a straight answer about, okay, how do you issue warrants? Who exactly issues warrants? And what if you're improperly intercepted? Is there any, are you ever notified? Well, no, you're not. And you have no recourse to justice. That's really my end point. Free speech is not the danger of humanity. Concentration of power is.
Paul Tweed is a defamation lawyer from Northern Ireland.
I'm firmly in favour of free speech, provided that it's fair, accurate and honest speech. The big difficulty that I think we have and we will have over the next number of years is in dealing with people who are going out and abusing free speech, abusing the power that has been given to them online by harassing people, by creating such havoc out there that people from all walks of life have actually committed suicide as a result of online bullying. An Irish politician last year, a number of school kids just towards the end of the year. And it's a very serious situation, which is just as important as the abuses that appear to have been taking place by the GHQ, whether or Bloomberg or whatever, all these certainly high-level international scenarios where privacy has been breached. So there's a very broad battlefield, and my big difficulty is that being in the front line every day, where I have clients coming in and they're asking me, can you stop this? And one lady contacted me this morning. Details of her daughter's 15-year-old daughter's sex life had been posted online and tweeted about and whatever. She was in hysterics and she wanted to know what I could do. 2 weeks ago, I took action against a website that had, in fairness, I actually had a lot of respect for it. It was its aim was to expose the wrongs of bankers and financial institutions, but they published information that was blatantly false about a client of mine. It was highly damaging to him, and my client, I should say as well, was a great advocate of free speech. He didn't want me to go after them with all guns blasting, seeking damages, whatever. He just wanted me to ask them to take it down, retract, and apologise. The website concerned took the information down, but refused to apologise, refused to explain, and instead decided to publish my letter and then attack me personally for being the greatest threat to free speech in Irish history. I then had little alternative but to follow up, and when I took the gloves off, I did it again. I made sure that I kept one hand tied behind my back. My client's insistence, I didn't seek damages, I didn't seek costs, I just asked them to reconsider their position, albeit quite firmly, and that if they didn't do that, I would unmask them. I would find out that this website, I should have said at the outset, was hiding behind a mask of anonymity. And I formed an association with a leading national Sunday newspaper, and between the two of us, we certainly got very close to finding out who was behind the website. They lost their nerve. They immediately terminated the website, but in a last act of defiance, they left online the allegations about my client and my letter. Now, I then received that Sunday morning a barrage of threatening emails from bloggers, various people threatening me, my family, everything, for having the audacity to challenge this website. Now, fortunately, having survived 30 years of the troubles in Northern Ireland, and you know, having had to check under my car quite a few times, it takes a lot to worry me, and certainly these guys didn't worry me in the slightest. But they would worry other people. They would worry you, any individual sitting here tonight, if perhaps you have had the audacity just to ask for a record to be set straight. This is a sort of power and venom that, you know, we're faced with on a daily basis. So there has to be a balance. Free speech has to be protected at all costs. But we need to have some degree of control. And Kirsty's probably wincing when I say that word, control. But it is necessary in a civilised society to have that degree of control.
Kirsty Hughes focused on questions of international governance of the internet.
There's a kind of geopolitics around digital freedom. And of course, what I have in mind in particular is the debates around who controls the internet. And are we going to have top-down UN or some other form of control of how the internet is regulated, which Russia and China have been arguing for, or are we going to have that non-soundbite phrase, a multi-stakeholder internet, in other words, one that is influenced by all sorts of actors and players and isn't controlled top-down. And that was at this, to some obscure summit, the International Telecommunications Union Summit in Dubai, and that was when you saw a lot of media wake up and say, oh, this looks like the online version of the Cold War, and we've got the EU and the US on the good side, and China and Russia on the bad side, and we've got countries like Brazil and India, and we're a bit worried about them, because Brazil actually voted with the Russians and China in Dubai, and India wavered, but then actually finally came on the other side. And that is a discussion that has become very live and is going to stay live in the next couple of years, because there's a sequence of international summits where these issues are going to come up for grabs again and again. What I think is really worrying about that is when you start to delve into that and say, what are some of the things we're actually worried about here? We're actually worried about some of the most basic things. Censorship, we're worried about surveillance. And you might think in a caricature world, you'd go, well, yes, China, censorship, China, surveillance, Europe, Britain, America, you know, hopefully not censorship. And maybe until a few days ago, some people might have said, hopefully not surveillance. And now we've got PRISM. And I think, though, just a couple of comments on both of those two big issues. On the censorship side, yes, China excels with its firewall. But look across a number of democracies. Look at Brazil and India and the number of takedown requests they make for content. It may be because of religious sensitivities, it may be for political sensitivities. Look what's going on in the UK. Somebody already talked about offence. Everybody seems, a lot of people seem to suddenly be feeling they shouldn't be offended, almost like they have a right not to be offended. We've seen people arrested and prosecuted and with sentences passed in some cases for being offensive online. The most recent case being someone given a community service order for tasteless to many remarks about the Woolwich killing. We've seen teenagers arrested for posting photos of burning poppies on Facebook. And actually, ironically, this comes from a law, it's the Comms Act 2003, but a law that has its roots in the 1930s, and that is also underpinning Indian laws. And we've seen the same sort of criminalisation of offence on social media in India with roots back to that same law. So I think there we've now got some interim guidelines trying to rein this in, but it's not clear to me yet that they're working. And just one last issue to throw into the ring there is the privatisation of censorship. We saw last week a campaign by a series of women's groups to get Facebook to take down pictures of battered and women who have been assaulted and attacked. And if you look at Facebook's rules, that would seem to me to fit with their rules, so why shouldn't they take it down? But my question is, if Facebook is now a space with a billion people, and it's setting the rules for a public space of a billion people, how do we hold them to account in the way that we can hold a government to account or argue for what sort of libel laws or privacy laws we want? I don't have time to say much about surveillance, but I'll just conclude with a couple of comments. One is to say that I think the more you have mass surveillance, whether it's this extraordinary numbers we're seeing with PRISM, even if there's a lot that's still obscure about PRISM, but these extraordinary numbers, or the snoopers charter as proposed in the UK, seems to me not only invades the right to privacy, but it also chills free speech. And so I think it's extremely disturbing. Going back to where I started, the geopolitics of digital freedom, if the next 2 years or 3 years, as many people have been arguing, is crucial for the fights and arguments about keeping the internet free in terms of global governance and global politics, then PRISM, as we see it so far, seems to me to have hugely, hugely undermined the ability of the US to be out there arguing for internet freedom against the Chinese government. It's starting to look, in the surveillance sense, even if not yet in the censorship sense, very like them. So I think PRISM is extremely problematic in itself, but it's also very problematic in terms of what it does to that crucial current geopolitical debate.
Thanks, Kirsty. So what we've got is a number of themes, and some of them intersect and some of them don't quite. That's fine. That's what this kind of discussion is about. But it does strike me, Heather, you must have had some thoughts on hearing what Paul had to say. You can say, as you did, as was implied, we don't want pictures of battered women on Facebook. Then in that case, how can we deny somebody else the right to be offended by something else that they want to see taken down from the internet that somebody else is doing? Because their argument will be that it will be subjective. And then that becomes a question of who sets the rules and how. And that actually is the great big overarching theme, really, that would develop from some of this, wouldn't it? Which is, who decides and how?
There are two ways to try and prohibit things. And trying to prohibit speech is always an incredibly difficult matter, because what you're trying to do is prohibit ways people think, right? And actually, just putting a restriction of law, trying to criminalize that, doesn't actually change the way people think. And what you, the thinking that's behind the First Amendment is that the way you counter erroneous or offensive information is with more information, is with more debate. And I'm definitely a subscriber to that view. If somebody's doing something on Facebook which is offensive, then it's our societal values that we come to some kind of consensus about, that the pressure, the social pressure, almost like the peer pressure, but we're not teenagers. But there is a sense of peer pressure builds up, and it no longer becomes acceptable, and they have to take action, which they've done. I mean, there was things about rape T-shirts, and we don't have to pass a law for Facebook to take action on that.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Because one of the things that was noticeable in the Liam Stacey case, Liam Stacey was the guy who tweeted stuff about Fabrice Muamba after he collapsed. And Anthony Hope, who died, when he was originally tweeting out to what he thought was a relatively small number of people and so on, but it was then retweeted. The judge, in making the judgment that he should go to prison, said that it had offended the public sense of at that moment. Mm. In other words, if the judge effectively said was, we believe and we wanted Fabrice Muamba to get better, and we didn't want this kind of stuff. This man, in a sense, assaulted our idea of what was proper.
But what I'm saying is, I don't think that the law is there to try and do this arbitration. I mean, it's a societal thing, and the pressure of the group is enough to stop people from doing it or to punish people when they do it. The danger if you start trying to put laws in is that it's an incredibly blunt instrument, and it catches so many people. And also the danger of chilling speech is so great. If there's any problem about anything, the way that you can bring it out in society is through speech, right? So no matter what it is, I mean, I'm thinking about the Tunisian guy, who set himself on fire. I mean, he had to take such drastic action because there was no speech outlet for that problem. And the point is that you've got to leave these channels open so as many people as possible can speak. And if you don't like what they have to say, as I often don't, I mean, if you're a woman that perhaps spoken on the web, I mean, you get a lot of crap thrown your way. And, you know, I don't like it, but I would never want to, I don't want to say criminalize it. And then as a society, I think we can all witness that and say, well, actually, I don't think that's acceptable. And I don't want, you know, this is just not acceptable. So we don't need to pass a law about it. We just see what it is and okay. We move on.
Thanks. Corey.
So I think let's start by saying that there's an enormous difference between regulation that requires the policing of speech in a certain direction and uneven or bad policing of speech by a private actor. That it's possible for Facebook to be wrong about how it polices speech or right about how it polices speech in as a matter that is completely separate from questions of whether or not the government requires Facebook to police its speech. And to me, actually, the fact that Facebook is a place where many of us are, I'm not, for the record, and I think you shouldn't be either, but Facebook is a place where so many of us are, and that they have arbitrary rules about how we conduct ourselves, is actually part of a larger conversation we should have about online freedom, which is about the unconscionability of license agreements that we have adhesion contracts rammed down our throats, and the American equivalent of which, Consumer Union, tells us that it would take 27 hours a day to review all the license agreements you agree to as you move around the web. It's literally impossible to know. And of course, we don't read them because we know that if you look closely at them, they all say some approximation of, you know, by being dumb enough to use this service, you agree you're allowed, that we're allowed to come over your house and punch your grandmother, wear your underwear, and wear, you know, make long distance calls and eat all the food in your fridge. And then there's an I agree button at the bottom. We all know there's no point in reading it because the one thing we're sure of is that we don't agree. So yes, by all means, let's talk about license agreements. Let's have a rational doctrine of unconscionability that extends to non-negotiated agreements. By the way, by sitting in the audience tonight, you all agree to release me from any agreements I've entered into with your employers. By sitting where you are, you further agree that you have the ability to release me from those agreements. Thank you very much. But to the question of what a good speech regulation is and whether or not regulations on speech on the internet are good or not, one dimension of this that we have to consider is that when you have a rule whose enforcement turns on something that is wholly subjective, and one of the objections frequently raised to British libel law is that it doesn't have truth as an initial defense, that you can't go through the pretrial process and then walk away just by showing you've said the truth. You have to show that you've said the truth in good faith. And that is such a fact-intensive question, and so arcane, and so hard to judge, and the jurisprudence requires such expertise to be on the right side of, that it creates a situation in which just proving that you were right is very expensive, and finding out whether you should prove that you were right is very expensive. And again, you know, as a Canadian, I'm meant to be quite hostile to Americans, and in many cases I am. But in this case, there's something that many American states got very right, which is their SLAPP legislation, which is strategic litigation against public participation. It creates a low-cost, streamlined court process by which you can show, or you have an opportunity to show, that a libel action has been undertaken for the purpose of squashing legitimate public participation. And if you can show that in that very low-cost hearing, it doesn't go to a full trial, and you're awarded costs from your opponents. And, you know, this has come up for the website I edit, Boing Boing, where we had someone who came after us, and we were able to show that he was only doing it because we criticized one of his products. The court ordered him to pay the $58,000 of the $60,000 it cost just to move through that low-cost streamlined procedure and saved us $1 million libel suit. That is not perfect, but it's certainly better than he who has the fattest checkbook controls the speech.
Kirstie, why is it better, or is it seen to be better, that we think that Facebook should decide what we can and can't do, and the government shouldn't?
I actually think it's something to do with scale, because in various of our different jobs and what we do, we make editorial decisions all the time. You know, we select who's on this panel tonight. We at Index, we decide what's on our website. You know, we're a publisher and we publish a magazine and we make choices. And just, you know, and the BBC decides that you shouldn't swear on most of its programmes or something like that. So I think you could argue that Facebook is just a club like anything else, and you know, if you don't like its rules and you think they're too restrictive, you can go somewhere else. But once it turns out that it's a club that's, you know, almost a sixth or a seventh of the world's population, and it is setting those borders of speech, then I start to use that term privatisation of censorship, and it's not clear to me that governments are better. They may be, you know, they may be worse in some ways. Look at the criminalisation of social media in the UK, but at least we, you know, we elect them, we hold them to account, or we attempt to hold them to account, and we know what's actually going on. Whereas with Facebook, I mean, you know, Index is also, we're a kind of hybrid. We're a media organisation and an NGO. We lobby to change things, and these groups of women lobbied Facebook very effectively to change things. But that's not the same as democratic politics, is it? So I think what we have with a lot of these big companies is that they're taking decisions that are very intrusive into what's our new public spaces, and yet we can't have a proper debate with them about it. We can't actually hold them fully to account about it. And lots of them, you know, they say they want to have those discussions, they want to commit to free speech and so on, but it's not an open process.
But what's your response to Heather's point, which is actually most of these things are just better argued out? That we, in fact, quite a lot of your clients don't need the protection they seek in quite that way, not at the cost of inhibiting free speech and so on. What they need to do is to go online and say, you're a liar.
Well, unfortunately, in the world that I inhabit, David, that just isn't practical. I mean, if, say for the sake of argument, somebody decides to call you a paedophile tomorrow, and with the internet now, it goes viral, it takes 5 or 6 seconds to go from London to Sydney to LA, so it's out there. It's gone, it's happened. The remedies that I can bring in, and normally I am sort of the line of last resort, because most people don't want to come near a lawyer unless they absolutely have to, and with my workload at the moment, I'm very grateful if they don't come near me. But there's very little that I can do at the moment. I mean, up until about 2 years ago, Google, Facebook, all these social networking sites and search engines just copped a snoop at me because they were operating from the safe haven of the United States. Then they decided to come to Ireland for tax purposes so that they could avoid having to pay tax. And they've had to submit to European, UK and Irish libel and privacy laws. And as a result, we've had a little bit more control over them. And they have then introduced these various procedures that have been referred to by the other speakers. They didn't introduce the procedures because they wanted to. They did because they had to. And it provides a bit of protection. I mean, the practicalities of this situation is that we are fighting an impossible situation against these online giants. Unless there's some degree, if there is, there's got to be a button somewhere to protect the ordinary man in the street here.